41 tries in four games during the Champions Cup quarterfinals at the weekend, and the headlines were that Harlequins pulled off a stunning win against Bordeaux and Leinster dumped out reigning champions La Rochelle. Joining myself and the columnist to review those games as well as look ahead to the rest of the Gallagher Premiership season is former Leicester, England and Bristol back row and Bristol Bears defence coach Jordan Crane. Champions Cup quarterfinal weekend was in some cases unpredictable, in others very, very predictable. Toulouse and Northampton dispatch Exeter and a second string Bulls side. The defending champions are out as La Rochelle crashed out to Leinster. And the headline of the weekend was a very Harlequins-like, stunning Quins win over Bordeaux that none of us saw coming. Joining us today is a former Heineken Cup finalist, England international, Leicester Tigers and Bristol Bears back row, Jordan Crane. Did you watch much of the weekend, Jordan?
Yeah, I watched all four games when I could, when the kids weren't bothering me. So, no, it's a great weekend. Obviously, that Quins game was the one that was probably the best game of the weekend. I didn't think we had Bordeaux in our group, and I thought they were probably one of the favourites to win it. So, fair play to Quins.
Jordan, the theme of my rubbish this weekend will be 41 tries in four games in knockout rugby. You're a defence coach. where is defence coaching with the laws as they are? I mean, I know you can't pick on just one individual game or one individual weekend and draw a load of conclusions from it, but 41 tries. I mean, there have been whole Lions tours without 41 tries.
Yeah. No, I think it's the way the game's going, isn't it? Everybody wants to see more tries, more spectacle, try and make the game more entertaining. So the laws are always going to favour the attack because that's what people want to see. You want to see tries. So as a defence coach, it's trying to, how can you negate that? But also us at the Bears, obviously, we want to play. So my job is to be able to play with that high-risk style and then be able to transition to defence as quick as possible. So it is tough, but I think it's the way that the game's going. I think everything that I see, they're trying to speed up rook, get rid of the caterpillar rook, all these things, which allows defences to get set. So, you know, even as a defence coach, I think it's great for the game in terms of be more entertaining, being opening up to a bigger audience. So it's just one of those challenges that you've got to get your head around and sort of plan against, really. And how can you beat the system?
But Jordan, I'm not convinced
rucks to have a ruck.
What's that?
Wouldn't one way of speeding up rucks would be to have a ruck, wouldn't it? I.e., get past the ball in numbers, therefore, we've had this discussion many times on this podcast. Those old farts like me who quite used to like watching the All Blacks or the Scots or really, really good rucking sides. I mean, that was an amazingly dynamic form of rugby compared to some of the stuff we've seen since the ruck's demise.
Well, exactly. So you need to have a ruck, but you need that quick ball. So by slowing it up doesn't help anyone, and nobody wants to watch it. I say nobody, probably a few purists or the team that you support if it's successful. I think rugby sort of got caught in this trap of you win games by kicking the ball more than the opposition. There was like a big stat around kick meters, and who wins the kick meters wins the game. And I think that's sort of starting to get flipped on its head a little bit, starting to change. Obviously, Leicester won the Premiership by doing it with Steve Borthwick, and it was very successful, but obviously they had the power game to go with it. I really enjoyed the weekend, even though a lot of tries, a lot of games. I think some of that was the scores got blown out in the end. I think obviously Exeter probably got caught out by the weather. Tough season so far. Small squad, they've done amazing to get to that position, but then unreal in the first half, and then probably just got, you know, the strength of Toulouse sort of came through in the end, and well documented the team that the Bulls took to Northampton. It was always going to be tough for them.
I think it's It's the old story, isn't it? I mean, it had gone too far defensively, especially that, remember that autumn COVID series where England, you know, declared themselves frightened to be in possession of the ball and kick it away. I think it's gone a little bit too far the other way. I mean, the match in Bordeaux was a genuinely great match, but not all 42 40s or whatever it was are great matches. Some of them are unwatchable, in my opinion. And a lot of the high scoring, bit gratuitous, you know, three or four of the tries are probably forward passes, and that undermines the actual genuine scores that are brilliant. And when you're getting 10 tries a match, you can do without two or three of the illegal tries if you're still getting six or seven tries. So I think it's gone too far the other way. And I don't think everybody is in love with multi-try rugby. And I think that we'll find that in the seasons to come. So it's gone too far the other way now. We need to get back to the middle ground, which is where we were about 15, 20 years ago. I don't know. You just need to have proper attacking rugby where the defence can compete. They can keep the score within realms. And actually, a 23-20 is just as exciting as a 43-40.
I mean, that was a rant. Wait a minute, Ren. Calm down, son.
Yeah. There you go. Just had a coffee, haven't I?
Morning.
That's using my rubbish.
Morning, Jordan. Morning.
Morning, how are you?
For late appearance. Look, I think that one of the things is that if you look at the driving maul, that is legalised obstruction as it is at the moment. It's the only area of legalised obstruction in the game. The tries from it are much too easy to come by. You know, the 5-metre drive is now a gimme, because, or almost a gimme, because the defending side is almost, I'd say 80% of the time, 85, 90% of the time, is always going to be penalised for either offside or collapsing. So, they, you know, there are areas of the game which they really need to look at, because they're becoming areas of fundamentally of no contest. And the contest for possession, that's the real area that needs to be looked at. It's got to be a more or less a 50-50. Or perhaps 60-40 in favour of the attacking side, but no more. And at the moment, the laws have slewed it in many areas towards the attacking side. Maybe it needed to happen to a degree, but I agree with Bren that there needs to be a correction also. Because, you know, and the forward pass stuff is just, you know, I reckon it's obviously coached, particularly the, you know, the close quarters forward pass, the speed with which it happens. So coaches have got a responsibility as well, because, you know, forward passes undermine, as Bren said, they undermine quality tries, and the camera angles and the way in which officials just wave them through time after time after time is, again, doing the game no favours.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not picking on you, Jordan.
No, well, I was going to say.
Well, no, we're talking up in defence coaches, basically.
It's all good. Like, I can, right, both points, similar, like the 5-metre maul, obviously, first hit, first place the refs look is the defending team. So, obviously, even like if they suck you forwards in and then they're hitting a short runner, it's the attacker that breaks the 10 first every time, but it'll be the defence who get penalised for breaking the 10.
Yeah.
If they follow him. So you're always at a disadvantage, both sides, and they'll always look at the defence first. They did bring in the rule about bringing bodies out around the ball early to maul and a free kick, and we saw that at the start of the season, but it's sort of something that's then just sort of gone passed away. So agree. I think probably one of the things around the maul that will possibly be looked at is people adding bodies post-maul. So where teams bring the backs in, you know, lots of teams use it. We use it because it is a massive advantage, because if you set your maul, it's always going to be weight on weight. And as a defence, you can't put as many in as the attack because you'll be really exposed. So you're always going to lose the pushing contest when they add three backs to a maul if they're set up. So it's probably something that they're looking at. And the final thing was about coaching forward passes. I'm pretty sure I don't think any team coaches forward passing. You know, rugby's rugby, and if it's forward, it should be called forward. You've got two touch judges and a ref who can see it. I don't I don't know why you need to go to camera angles. They're up with the play. A forward pass is a forward pass, and it's been like that for however long rugby's
been.
But
they have stopped reffing it, I'd say, Jordan. And on the coaching thing, you watch the guys warm up. Sometimes you see them do a little short passing routine. Not one of the passes is legal. Every pass is a foot forward. So they're certainly not coached to do proper, genuine passes.
Yeah, no, like I can only comment on every environment that I've been in and everywhere that I've coached, and I haven't seen anyone coach forward pass. So,
listen, I believe that, but what I think is that, you know, I mean, it started with the All Blacks, you know, and very often they're the you know, they're the pace setters in these things. The inability of referees and touch judges to call it, and the frequency with which commentators who also overlook it a hell of a lot in the interests of attacking rugby, I'm sure. But when they do call it and the officials haven't called it, that is when they usually get looked at. Mm. So the officials, you know, we've had the thing with Austin Healey, the officials are very often, you know, late to the call. When it comes to forward passes, and will very often only be prompted by broadcast commentators who say, I think, oh, well, that probably needs to be looked at. And then we hear that the TMO is looking at it. You know, I mean, it's a mess.
And the other great thing, lesson Nick, of our age, Nick, isn't it? Everything in rugby comes back to Austin Healey.
You're making friends again.
my old buddy Austin, bless him. He's still the best analyst on the TV, mind. Oh, he's certainly got the sharpest eyes.
He
should be a TMO.
Yeah, he's hawk-eyed, isn't he? Yep.
He could be a TMO while commentating.
We didn't talk about the Matt Dawson episode last week, but who enjoyed Matt's story about Austin subbing himself on deliberately for Matt in the third test?
It's brilliant. That's the first 97 line story, news story I've heard for years. That was cracker.
I've never heard anything like that.
So good. Let's talk about Harlequins a little bit more, guys, because I think rather than, well, nitpick the fact that we saw all these tries, I think talking about giving Quins credit where credit's due. And Kano, I'm glad you've joined us now, because I was going to bring you in on the Quins front row, which, mm-hmm. You know, none of us saw this coming. We thought Bordeaux would have too much power. And Finn Baxter pretty much took apart 150 kilos plus opposite him in Ben Tamifuna. Is that the kind of performance that kickstarts, not necessarily an international career, but certainly puts him on the international radar?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, the thing about him is that the rate of improvement is meteoric, because when he started the season, I mean, you could see that he's really game and physically pretty, you know, powerful, but his technique wasn't really there. But during or at least had flaws in it, but during the course of the season, he's got better and better. And the proof of the pudding was in Bordeaux, where he should have played himself onto the plane for England summer tour without a doubt. And they've got a lot of, you know, they've got a lot of loose heads vying for it, but Joe Marler's probably coming towards the end, as is Dan Cole. Now, it's the bloke on the other side who interests me just as much as Baxter, because he's now going to Castra, where their chairman, Gerard Sholley, knows a tight head when he sees one. I'm not sure that Steve Borthwick always does. And, you know, Collier's been looked at by England, but Collier's performance in that game was outstanding. Absolutely outstanding for a tight head.
Jordan, you were a England child prodigy. Is age any kind of barrier amongst the forwards? That is, I mean, when you were a very young player playing top end club rugby, I mean, what would you have been? 17, 18, I suppose.
18.
Did you feel very young when you were suddenly thrust into that sort of top end club level?
Not really. Like, obviously, you train with the guys every day. You're coming off the back of it. I think it's less common now than back then. There was more of us who sort of came through, and especially in the front row. Like, as you're talking there about Finn Baxter, he played against. I took over the academy when I first retired from Bristol, and he played against our under-18s about 4 years ago. And so where he's got to in a short space of time is been unreal, and he's really that performance at the weekend was class. I don't think there's going to be a harder place for him to go, and for them to be so dominant as well was excellent. But I think the thing is like with anything, sport, people are going to be ready at different stages. Like people, like he's ready now. He's ready to go, ready to play. There might be somebody else who's ready at 24, especially in that front row and the forwards. Like myself, I was ready. I was confident. I was ready to enter that stage at 18. When I was playing at Leicester, straight in at 20, probably the youngest in that team at the time. So you know, some people are ready, younger, maturer, ready to get on with it and confident in themselves. There's other people who take longer to sort of get to grips with it and almost learning how to be a professional. It's the ones who can learn to be able to cope with the demand of day to day, your body's sore, I've got to get up, I've got to go do it again, week to week, to back up performance consistently is the thing that they need to learn more than if they're a good enough rugby player.
And also, your confidence must have been sky high, John, because you came off a school that rarely lost, Colston's. You had back-to-back Grand Slams at age group level with England, didn't you, at 21s and 19s. You must have been absolutely flying as an 18, 19-year-old in terms of personal confidence.
Pretty much. Like Colston's was the machine that just, you know, made a lot of us in terms of our mentality, the way that we played the game, that you know we won every game that we played in. And we just breathe that confidence. Like I sort of struggle with the development part of it, where some people say, oh, it doesn't matter about the result. It doesn't matter about the result. So my lad's in Bristol City Academy, and he went and played in a tournament where there was knockouts. He's only 8, but they were like, oh, it doesn't matter about the results, like just go and enjoy it. But for me, part of the development is, yes, the individual needs to develop and everything, but also they need to learn how to win and be winners, and those tough games, be able to big moments in games, to be able to bring back those experiences that they've had, win or lose, to get them going. So so for part of my development, and at that age, I was like, this is amazing. We don't lose. The mentality was to win. I went straight to a Leeds team that we lost a lot. So I learned a lot there. And then obviously going to Leicester then just took that with me that I'm ready to win and that and yeah.
The age thing is interesting because I think we'd all agree that it's easier to be a young back and nail down a spot, starting spot than it is a young forward. You look at the Northampton back line, I think they're 9 to 15 at the weekend, and obviously their back line ran riot. The average age was 23. It's no secret that England, particularly in the tight, well, on the tight head side, there's a shortage of props. Jordan, do you think part of that is related to clubs being reluctant to field props? You know, Joe Hayes is it probably well 25 plus now, and obviously hasn't really nailed down a starting berth at Leicester Tigers. And Finn Baxter's 22 now. Is this the point to say, okay, Joe Marler is probably still our best loose head prop, but he said he's retiring from rugby in 2025. Finn Baxter has to be sort of jettisoned almost to play in that one shirt for Quinn so that he can be ready a lot earlier than some of our tight heads haven't been ready.
Yeah, and you have to plan that way as a club. How are we gonna develop these guys, and when are they gonna be ready? Like some of them might not get there, but you've got to give them the opportunity to get there. And that's always the tough one, because every club wants to be successful now, and they want to plan for the future. So it's very fine balance between the two. And obviously now there's less games as well. So a lot of these players would get opportunities during Six Nations, autumn internationals. But where now, obviously, we've just had a 7-8 week break during the Six Nations, so there's less opportunities for them now. So where do they go? Where do they fit in?
Well, I guess one of the answers to that is the championship, you know, and that pathway is sort of in jeopardy a bit at the moment, given the talks that are going on. But that's the place where they should be cutting their teeth without any doubt at all. I just wanted to come back to Collier. Collier is, Dan Cole, I think, is 36, pushing on 37. Collier's 32,
yeah,
I think. And he's going to Castra next season. But he should be on the plane to New Zealand as well. There's no question in my mind at all about that. England haven't got, as we've said, they've got a shortage of tight heads. And he is the best tight head that England have got at the moment, in my view, and that includes Dan Cole. So he is the guy who should be there. I'd put Will Stewart at Bath, and Joe Hayes, neither of whom can get in starting berths at their clubs, behind him without a shadow of a doubt. And I don't understand why he hasn't been there for a long time. He's a better scrummager than Carl Sinclair. Sinclair managed to get managed to get the nudge ahead of him at Harlequins. I think Collier has been hard done by at test level, and it's time that was rectified.
Yeah.
Do you think there is value to putting him on the, even though he'll be obviously ineligible 2 months later, and obviously
against the All Blacks, I wouldn't bugger about. Get him on the plane.
And actually, a shout out, as we're talking about young forwards, when we previewed the game last week, we didn't know that Chandler Cunningham South was going to be fit. Now, I'm not saying it would have changed our view, but my God, he is a unit. He is a fast developing player, under 20 international last season. And his first half performance was, again, a key component of that Quinns win. The go forward he gave them and the sort of quick start he gave them, and they got the lead, got into the game, was really important. So a big shout out to him, another who needs to be on that plane.
Yeah, and well, I think we can be pretty sure he will be.
I think so. I think England have clocked him, but of course he'd gone quiet because of the injury in the last 5 weeks. But
Jordan, on the tight heads, I mean, Nick makes a number of good points. It's his specialist area, actually, even though he was too scared to play in the front row himself.
and you know that feeling, don't you, Chris?
I was comfortably the fattest back row player in the club side I played for, so if there were any injuries, I would invariably end up in the front row. And I, as I've said before, saw bits of myself you don't usually see without the aid of a mirror.
Yeah, like you, Chris.
Where's Carl Sinclair's? Where's his rugby at the moment, Jordan? I'm not asking for any trade secrets, but I mean, there were times when Carl looked as though he was set fair for a very long England career. He had a great skill range. Still has a great skill range, I'm sure. Where has it gone wrong for him particularly? And if so, where do you think the shortfall has been?
In truth, I think he probably 12 months ago probably had a dip, and you know, I think since he's got back from the World Cup. And he didn't get selected by England, and obviously he's leaving us at the end of the season. It's been the best I've seen him play. He was brilliant against Gloucester in our last Prem game, Northampton the week before that. A lot of the games that we've won, he's been massive. And when we beat Sale away at the start of the year, he was our best player. So I think almost taking that burden off him of England, is he going to get selected and all this, is sort of freed him up. And, you know, I would say he's probably on his best run for us as Bristol Bears at this current time. And, you know, for me, Collier was outstanding at the weekend, and he's been he's a great tighter prop. And 100%, I think he should have been capped for England. But if you're going to take one to New Zealand, I'd take Kyle Sinclair over Collier, who are both in the same situation. They're both going to France at the end of the year. But it's the same for England as this, as club rugby, where we're talking about how do we get that progression, how do we get people through. So I can't see them taking anyone who's going to be going to France at the end of the year to New Zealand.
Just a last one on Kyle. I mean, he was frequently characterised by us lot in the press and in the media as a sort of mood player, if you see what I mean. That when he was on it, he was properly on it. But you could never quite guarantee that he was going to be on it when you needed him to be on it. Is that fair or a complete misreading of him?
No, I think obviously he's an emotional guy, and sometimes he can get distracted by other things. But when he's on, he's one of the best tight heads in this country. You know, in terms of ball playing, in terms of set piece, in terms of everything he's got. And lucky for us, at the minute he's on, and he's well, he's engaged in what we're doing. And you know, I just think he's one of those that the thing is with rugby now is the old school mentality is that everybody's the same, everybody's got to buy into the same thing and do the same thing. But society's changed, people have changed. You have to understand the person to get the best out of them. And I'd probably say with Kyle, maybe with England, didn't necessarily understand him completely to get the best out of him. And it's probably took us a few years to understand that and how to get him to the best spot.
Yeah.
That's a mark of the great coaches, isn't it? The people management, or almost the psychology of coaching, because almost by definition, everyone who's playing professional rugby is a pretty damn good player. I mean, better than everyone who isn't playing professional rugby. And people who are of test quality are even more so. So then you're talking to about the real minutiae of motivation and understanding and making people feel that they want to give the best of themselves and feel capable of giving the best of themselves.
But consistency of performance is always rests first and foremost with the player.
Yeah,
and I don't agree entirely with you know, I mean, I know that you obviously you're close to him, he's at Bristol and so on. I think that there's a difference between test level scrummaging and a lot of club scrummaging. And I think that at test level, consistently over the last, you know, over leading up to him being dropped, he was just not at that level required when it came to the really big games. And I think that that's why he went. And incidentally, in terms of longevity, Chris, he had a very, very good England career. I mean, he's got over almost 70 caps under his belt. That's not something to be, you know.
And Lions tours as well.
Yeah, and Lions tours too. So I think he's, you know, I'm not saying that anybody, you know, should have the, you know, the curtain drawn on them for good, because, you know, it is a game where people, you know, get, you know, bursts of fantastic form sometimes, and maybe he'll come into that. But I certainly wouldn't take him ahead of Collier at the moment. And the idea that, you know, given that they're available to England, if England want to have a chance of winning a test series in New Zealand, the one thing that they cannot afford is a scrum that's all over the shop, because New Zealand have improved in that area and they will target England because they have on the occasions that they've played them recently.
Yeah, we saw that the Hurricane scrum at the weekend was, I don't know if you watched that game, Nick, was very, very strong.
No, I didn't see it.
Okay, well, New Zealand scrummages are looking very, very impressive. But speaking of young, well, slightly less young forwards, but obviously a lot of players for Queens put their hand up for international selection. And one who's a really interesting one is Will Evans. Obviously, 27 years old. This is sort of a question to the floor, but he's one who is eligible beyond the New Zealand tour. Do we put him on the plane?
Have to be a pretty big player. Send the boot too.
I think we're taking all the Quinns players after the weekend.
Yeah, you've got to avoid the knee jerk of the great.
We're taking Nick Evans as a 10.
I think Will Evans was at the in the Leicester Academy when I was at Leicester. And great lad, unbelievable skill set, great player. He's done amazing at Quinns, and I think he's got the most turnovers in the Prem by a big stretch. You know, so he's right at that level. It's just the dynamic. The problem is with the back row, we got so many good back rows. Like I'd throw Fitz Harden in at Bristol as well. He's a great sort of seven, can cover the whole back row.
I'm glad you mentioned him. Yeah, he was superb the other day when I watched him. I thought, why is this guy not in the conversation?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I could name you another 5-6 across the Premiership. So it's the most competitive position. So we can make an argument for Will Evans if you want to go heavy jackal focused, which I don't think England will go down. If you look at, obviously, Felix Jones has come in. South Africa, they're a heavy sort of blitz, get up, go through the breakdown, make it a mess. So would Will Evans suit England the way that they want to defend? I don't know. That'd be a question for them. But 100%, if you put him in an England team, he would not look out of place. But I could say that about 5-6 other back rows who probably aren't going to be on the plane.
Yeah. I think that's a fair point. I guess when have England ever? I mean, Will Evans is a very lightweight seven, and you're right, he's the best jackaler we have. But I'm trying to think in the past 10, 15 years when England have ever picked such a lightweight seven, and I'm not sure they have.
Not since Neil Back.
No, exactly. I think he was probably the last one. I think you're bang on there.
And even back then, there were big conversations about Neil's size.
Oh, he was kept out of the team for a couple of years.
He missed out for ages, didn't he?
Yeah, I'd be interested to know, Jordan, what your thoughts are about back row balance, because, you know, great back rows have always been, you know, traditionally, have been complementary, and how important that is now, whether it's as important as it was, because as you say, a guy like Fitz Harding can play right across the back row very, very well. And so is getting that back row balance a more difficult thing in the modern game, do you think, or not?
No, there's certain things that you've got to have to balance your back row. So one, you need somebody who's a good line out forward. Yep. So either that's usually your number six or your number eight. Like when we're at Leicester, we had Crofty, who was perfect balance. Yep. You need a ball carrier. So again, like if you go stereotypical, it's going to be your number eight. And then I think probably the one that's probably changed is probably the seven, is the role of the seven. It's not necessarily sort of that link player who links the backs and the forwards. It's not necessarily the jackler, depending on how it's gone, because it's so hard to get jackal penalties. Like the game now is all about, it's about destruction of the breakdown area. So a larger seven helps with that. If you look at South Africa, their back row, so Steph the Toy is their seven, but he's a big man who will make an absolute mess of everything in there. So for me, the balance, you have to have those two things. You need ball carrying, you need collision winners in there, and you need a line out forward. But ultimately now as a back row, you have to be able to do everything. And same as most positions now, there's no position that you can. So you talk about front rows, you talk about props. Now, back in the day, we had Julian. I was talking about this to somebody yesterday. Julian White, he would not want to touch the ball in a game of rugby. He'd be happy just maul, scrum, clean out rooks. Now you want your front rows. You want to make in 10 tackles a game. You want them. You want all the set piece, and you want them to carry the ball 10 times, and you want them to tackle 10 times. And it's the same with the back row. You want them to do everything. but their outstanding part needs to balance the back row out.
Julian White was just Darren Garforth, who was spotted by referees.
On the subject of the back rowers, I thought the outstanding performance of the weekend was Jack Willis. And the point I'd want to make about him is that he was a very good player before he went to Toulouse. He was a 8 out of 10 player every week. But in the last 3 or 4 months, he's added so much to his game. He's now a ball carrier when he wasn't really a ball carrier. He's a try scorer. He's a passer. And, you know, his game has come on 50%. And if ever there's been an advert for somehow finding a system where you can get some of our better players allowed to play in France and still play for England, I'd say he's the absolute prime example, because he's playing the best rugby of his life and he's only been there a year.
I'll tell you what.
I assume, Jordan, the Premiership, insofar as there is a collective approach on these things, the Premiership would be very reluctant for England's selection criteria to change, wouldn't it?
You know, you want your best players in the Premiership. You want the best product for us to sell, and, you know, for people to watch. So, you know, it makes it to our advantage to have the best England players in our league. The argument to it is, by these players going to different environments, seeing things done differently, does that make your international team better? And I'd probably argue it does. You look at, so you go back to South Africa, why have they won 2 World Cups in a row? They've got players in France, they've got players in England, they've got players in Japan, they've got players in South Africa. So they're taking all the IP back to South Africa when they come together. And, you know, it's got to improve you at some point, instead of everybody doing the same thing in the same country, coming together, still doing the same thing and hoping for the same result.
Like, IP is a big thing, Jordan, isn't it? I mean, how much intelligence is Geordie Barrett going to gather at Leinster, where they're coached by Nien Aber, so he's going to understand a bit of the sort of residual South African approach to everything. And he's going to find out everything he knows about Ireland, because he's effectively playing for Ireland.
Well, because you're not going to change. So the players coming back, you're not going to change the things that you do. South Africa have not changed the way that they've played off the back of it, but you have an understanding of what teams are trying to do. Yeah. And you might come across something that might tweak your game by 1-2%, but at test level, that's the difference, isn't it? South Africa won 1 point in the quarters, one point in the semi, 1 point in the final, and win a World Cup. So that's the difference for me.
Chewy, how did you react to that news when you saw it? I mean, Jordan, Geordie Barrett is Chewy's favourite person by a country mile. How did you react?
I don't know him personally, but I think if you were creating a 12, which is such a difficult position to fill, but if you were creating a 12 in a laboratory somewhere, but also wanted the human mind, you come up with Geordie. He can kick, pass, tackle, read a game, manage a game. He's got the size of getting through the traffic. He's a goal kicker. I mean, Jesus, what else do you want? Best since Tim Horan, in my view.
Drew, that's great, but none of it answered my question.
What was that? I tend to fade out when you're talking, Oliver. Sorry, what was that again?
That's very fair. How did you react when you saw the news?
My first thought was the person who's, and don't nip me ideas, because this is another piece for the weekend. My first thought was that the bloke who's laughing all the way to the bank is Scott Robertson. Because, as we've just discussed, he's going to come back with a bag of ideas, a bag of knowledge.
But presumably, well, it's already clear he's not being particularly well received across all of Ireland.
Well, we've established on this podcast, haven't we, that any Irish rugby figure on this podcast who doesn't come from Leinster or is not associated with Leinster bloody well hates Leinster. Because they've got, especially the Ulster boys. I mean, we haven't had anyone from Munster on yet because they'll swear too much. But the thing is, Leinster are all powerful. in Ireland, all powerful, right from age group rugby and schools rugby upwards. They're effectively Ireland in a different kit, and now they've got one of the world's premium players swanning over for the business end of a season where their chances of hoovering up Champions Cup and URC will only be improved. They're already strong, but now they'll be almost undeniable. If Barrett stays fit and plays the form, they'll win plenty, won't they?
Yeah, and that's a big question mark with All Blacks coming over the UK. But you know, Nienaber is going to find out a fair amount about Barrett too, and so are Leinster. So you know, there's a sort of quid pro quo to a degree when it comes to these guys coming over, what they take back and what you know, potential people in opposition find out about them. So, yeah, I mean, listen, it's a fantastic six-month purchase for Leinster, and you know, with RG Snyman also going there, you know, they're certainly cherry picking the top guys when it comes to acquisitions, that's for sure.
And it's a slightly more comfortable ride than you get for being in France, isn't it? I mean, you could go to France and get biffed around. I mean, seriously, biffed around.
The purchasing power of Leinster at the moment is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, you just look at their squad. They'll have, including the bench, they'll have 23 full internationals some days. I mean, I've seen a figure of 12 million is their wages alone, but that doesn't even begin to cover it because they've also got the full support of the IRU. You know, they've got the Aviva whenever they want it. They've got admin staff there. They've got medical staff facilities. It's all like you say, for Leinster, Reed Island. It's just, you don't want to complain too much, but it's becoming almost an unfair playing ground.
So, Brent, are they sort of racing favourites for the title this time round for the European?
Well, no, because I always think they've got a slight Achilles heel. The moment they find a ref who refs the breakdown, they're knackered. And it was completely bottled at the weekend. They were by far the best team, easily. But they were still getting away with murder at the breakdown. And if you get a ref, and the trouble with Leinster is they're clever. If they get pinged from the start, they will adapt and they don't offend. But halfway through a match, if a ref suddenly gets brave, like Jacko Piper did the other year, they're all at sea because everything they've been doing all season, all match, and been getting away with is now considered illegal. So there is always that little 1% in me thinks if they come across a ref who gets brave, they can still be beaten.
I think they're favourites for next year already. I'm not sure about this year. Guys, from one goal-kicking Geordie to another, Jordan, while we've got you on the podcast, we obviously want to relive probably I don't know if it's one of the greatest moments of your career. It's probably one of the most unlikely, maybe not given that you played West Brom under-14s, but Peter Jackson of the Rubber Paper just last week wrote an article recalling that kick of yours in Cardiff. It's coming up to 15 years on the day. I think it's May 3rd. But if we could just get you to relive that a little bit for us while we've got you here.
Yeah, no, it's probably not the greatest moment. It's probably the most talked about, I'd say. it was one of those games, and you go back to good games, good Heineken Cup games. Like, it was the game itself was a great game. We were 14 points up, conceded two late tries, go to extra time, and play 100 minutes. And we didn't even know that there was going to be a shootout at the end. So we've got to huddle, like, what's happening next? So we played 2-10 minutes of extra time. We thought we were going to golden point. We were going to keep playing. And they're like, no, penalty shootout. And we're like, oh, okay. luckily, the coaches knew, because so Julien Dupuy was our nine, and he goal kicked for us. So we took him off. Harry Ellis had come on, and literally five minutes to go at the before the end of extra time, Dan Hipkiss cut his head. So Julien Dupuy is coming back on. He's in the change room having a Heineken and a fag. and they've got to go back and get him out of the changing room. So our kit man goes back, gets him boots off, sat there, fag, can of Heineken, runs back down to the pitch, comes on, goes to the penalty shootout. Julian's up first, kicks his penalty, runs back to the changing room, finishes fagging his Heineken. He's all good. But no, it's just a real, obviously, growing up, football, everything, you dream of playing in an FA Cup final and scoring the winning penalty. So straight away, as soon as it started going, obviously the backs would go first, bar Harry, because he can kick the ball. So myself and Craig Newby said, yeah, we'll take one. So we're going anyway. Johnny Murphy, for us, misses, goes way left, and we're all stood in a huddle. And we've got the Prem semi against Bath the next week, so we're just in the huddle going, don't worry, boys, you know, it's completely unusual. Doesn't matter. We've just got to focus now on next week. We just got to focus. And so anyway, so in this huddle, just, you know, completely focused on, it doesn't matter, park it. It's been a great game. We fought to the end. And then Tom James misses. So then it's like, oh, we're back in now. We're back in with a shot. So anyway, a couple more go. I think Mage goes for us. Then Craig Newby goes before me. And then obviously Martin Williams misses. So then it comes to me. And for me, like, I had a free shot. So if I missed, we continued. If I scored, we win. So there wasn't loads of pressure, and I was only 22, 23 at the time. So when you talk about being young, you don't feel that pressure as much as you get older. You feel the pressure as you get older when you're more of a senior player in the team, and you know you captain teams and things like that. The outcome of the team sort of falls more responsible to you. But as a young player, I'm like, oh yeah, this is wicked. Like, we'll just go play, enjoy it. Yeah. So stepping up, not actually that nervous. But when you look at the posts, so if I stood out on the training field and looked at the posts on a normal day, you'd be like, I know that, easy, not a problem. It's not very far. Posts look big. With a full stand at the Millennium with the last kick on the game, they look pretty small, to be fair. So put it down, hit it, and then that was it. That was it. It wasn't my cleanest strike, that's for sure, but retired with a 100% kicking record. So,
did you I'll ever kick him in practice? I mean, did you, I mean, as a back row or forward, would you ever practice kicking as a young professional?
Yeah, so I used to kick at age groups, kick for Colston's, bits, and then all the back rows kick. So even our boys now still mess about it. Stephen Lewitter is always at it.
I'm sure that Martin Williams did.
Well, you'd have backed him 100%.
Yeah, you would, yeah.
To kick that.
Did you give him a magnanimous hug at the end?
No, I don't think. I think I said that to Peter Jackson. I'm like, nobody wants the opposition to come up and like, oh, well, I wouldn't. That's for sure. You just want to go back to the changing rooms and forget about it, don't you? So, you know. But you can feel for anyone who took one and you know, were on the wrong side of it. It could have easily been us. So it was great drama and a great experience to be part of. But I think we'd have preferred to have won it in normal time, and I'd give it all up to have beat Leinster in the final. We lost by three, which was bad. So that was probably the one thing that I could take back. I'd want to redo of that final.
And they had another ringer on that occasion, didn't they, in Rocky Elson.
Rocky Elson, man. Oh, probably the best individual performance in a whole Heineken Cup I've ever seen, from pool stages to final. He was unbelievable, unplayable at that time.
In fact, the whole Leinster success story goes back to him, doesn't it? They were complete underperformers until
Rocky that was their first one, wasn't it? So if we'd have won it, they
strangled him at birth.
It might have been different. Yeah. No.
I remember that final. I remember O'Driscoll was injured, and he ended up on the left wing, didn't he? He could barely move.
Yeah,
he was stuck on the left wing, and the ball found its way to him, and he made a sort of made some kind of break, which led to a pretty important score. And you sort of think, cranky, even when he's completely incapacitated, he sticks his nose in.
The one for me about that final was obviously Leinster's fly off at the time was Kontopomi.
Yeah.
And he got injured in the semi against Munster. And so we were like, oh, brilliant, like going into the final. And they had Johnny Sexton. And Johnny at the time, he was my age group at like age group level, and he wasn't the Johnny Sexton that you know and you see now. We were like, right, we're gonna get into him. Happy days, like young 10. We'll get into him. First couple of minutes, he's hit a drop goal from 50 metres. I was like, oh, shit.
Jordan, obviously, the fallout of that penalty shootout win was a sort of inquisition into the format. I think Jordan Murphy, pretty soon after the game, said that, you know, it felt like a pretty terrible way to win as much as it was a terrible way to lose. Do you prefer we all remember the Toulouse Munster shootout from a couple of years ago? Do you prefer that format, or do you think there's still a better way to do it?
I think the footballer in me likes the traditional way of penalties, and because it's so rare, it's probably more entertaining than the Munster one. But then, when you go about rugby values and things like that, it's probably a more sensible way to decide a game with three kickers who actually kick. But you know, if you look at the two, I'll probably say more drama was our one. But I think Steph Armitage kicked one, didn't he, for Biarritz to get promoted as well, which was the same format as ours. The footballer would say that one, probably the rugby sort of sensible option would be to use three kickers who can actually kick.
Well, if you're going to have a number seven kicking in a penalty shootout, you'd bet Martin Williams above Stephen Armitage, wouldn't you?
Oh, no, Steph can play. He can play. He's got some skills as Steph.
Here's a serious question for you, Jordan. As somebody who cut his teeth to a degree up at Leeds, what's your feeling about rugby in the... about the union game in the north? Is it been completely leagued out of anything like a future? I mean, Yorkshire's a very big county to be absent in union, which it effectively is for one reason or another.
Yeah, no, it's a tough one, isn't it? Because everybody, for us to be successful, we need rugby being played all over the country, up and down the country, and what helps out having a big team in your area who you can get behind. Obviously, experiencing that at Leeds. At Leeds at the time, we won the Power Gen Cup. We were in the Heineken Cup, and we were still only getting 4,000 or 5,000 people to a game, where if the Rhinos played, sell out 20,000-odd every single game. So, and as well, throwback to that time, we had big players at the time. We had Justin Marshall at nine, Andre Snayman, like big names, and still couldn't pull crowds in, and the appetite for it was pretty low. How do you conquer that market? I think that's probably the one thing that people are struggling to do. Do we need rugby in the north? 100%. Of course we do. And you see what Sale are doing. I think it's great. You know, they're getting bigger crowds at the AJ Bell. than they have for a while. And the more successful rugby can be up there, the bigger it's going to be for the country. So, and some of the best players come from up north. Like our Leeds Academy was brilliant. We had Danny Kerr, we had Rob Vickerman, Rob Webber, Luther Burrell, Keenan Mile. Like loads of boys came out of that age group. So, you know, there's plenty of talent up there. It's just getting the commercial stuff right.
I think I'm right in saying there's still more senior clubs in Yorkshire. I think about 79 or something like that than any other county. Yeah. So there's still a playing base.
Yeah.
It's transferring it into a spectator base.
Yeah. Is the commercial one? How can you make it more successful? And it starts with investment, doesn't it? Like everything. The game needs more money, more backers, and it, as much as a lot of fans want, you know, a lot of say and everything, but I think you need the financial backing of an owner or somebody who just loves the sport, who's willing to invest and, you know, be on that journey with whatever team it is.
Jordan, we've discussed what you called the most talked about moment of your career. I'd like to find out what the best moment of your career is. Do you mind if we do our quick fire question round?
Yep, sure.
We'll get going. Nickname?
Trainer.
Best rugby memory?
2013 Prem Final, Northampton.
Most embarrassing rugby memory?
Most embarrassing. Oh, probably not on the pitch. Probably some of the ladies' nights at Leicester doing a performance. There's a fair few of those.
I don't think I'm going to ask for detail.
No, please don't. Please don't. Yeah.
Pre-game tune.
No music. Old school Leicester mentality. Yeah.
Post-game meal?
Chinese.
Best player you've played against?
Against Dan Carter when he was at Perpignan. One of his four games at Perpignan, I think.
Nice. That's a good flex, to be fair. Best player you've played with?
Johnny Wilkinson.
Favourite player right now?
This is quick fire as well. I'll go easy. DuPont.
Got all that thinking. Rugby idol.
Rugby idol. Probably back in the day, Martin Johnson or Johnny Wilkinson.
Favourite stadium?
Stade Michelin, Clermont.
Nice. Favourite gym exercise?
Bench.
Occupation if rugby didn't exist?
Footballer.
Nice. at West Brom.
Good career choice, Jordan.
Yeah. Hey, you didn't say, is it realistic?
Superstitions.
Used to get ready exactly 50 minutes before kickoff.
5-0, not 1-5.
Not 1-5.
Okay, we'll be cutting it a bit tight. Rugby law you would change?
Probably the caterpillar.
Nice, yeah, good call. Best thing about working in rugby?
Doesn't feel like a job.
Nice.
Good answer.
Good answer. Well, you said your nickname's Crano. I apologise for calling you Geordie earlier.
I answer to anything, don't worry.
You'd be the problem with football is you're used to blazing penalties over the bar, so you'd need to keep them under the crossbar.
Yeah, no, I'd be all right at that.
It was West Brom under 14s, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. So me and my brother both in the academy at the time. So he was 2 years above me. He went on. He's only just retired. He had pretty much 20 years semi-professional footballer. So. I was literally only there 6 months and then decided to it was probably the straw that made me turn to rugby. It was my dad made us both play in goal, hated playing in goal. Go to an academy, you only play half a game a week as a goalie because they carry two goalies. I was like, this isn't for me. Friendship group changed when I went to high school. They all played football, rugby, sorry. Got in the county team. I was like, I want to go play rugby. And that was the decision then. Carried on playing for school and stuff. Got offered a YTS at Crewe at 16. I was playing county under 18s at sort of 15, and got offered that and to go down there and look around and stuff. And my mum was, what do you want to do? I got offered a scholarship to go to Colston's, and I was like, no, I want to play rugby. So she's like, there's no point going down. I'm not taking you down there. And that was it then. Didn't look back. And yeah.
Where did your brother play his football?
So he did end up doing like 3 years at West Brom and a year's pro at West Brom. Never played. And then as
a goalie?
As a goalie, yeah.
Okay, so he stayed.
Signed for Burton Albion. Played a load there. Rushton and Diamonds when they're in League Two. And then he sort of worked his way down from there. Solihull Moors, Hensford. And a load of other teams, as most non-league footballers do. I think he's probably had about 50 clubs by the end of his career.
And you said he's 2 years older than you?
2 years older, yeah.
So he retired at what?
He's turning 40 in May. So
well, as a goalie, you can do that, can't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
Although Jimmy Gobber's just got a new contract at the age of 40 down at...
exactly. John Afoa is only just retired. He was turning out. It's a lot harder than a goalie.
Yeah, well, Mark Schwartz is still playing? I mean, he was playing for Chelsea at the age of 37, 38. So it can't...
I don't think he played. He was on the bench, wasn't he?
All right, yeah. Playing for Chelsea.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but no, that's fair play. That's a long career. Jordan, I just want to do a quick 5 minutes on the Bears run into the end of the season, if that's all good with you.
Yep.
One thing, obviously, one piece of news that I think we should mention is a signing that no doubt you'd be very excited about in Bill Matter. People all remember his dummy try against England in that quarterfinal. Just talk about... Well, did you have anything to do with that signing? You must be excited to bring a player like him in.
Yeah, you know, I think he fits the style that we want to play the game. When obviously he came available to us, like it was exciting to sort of get him. We're looking for a back rower to who can carry the ball. When we were talking about that balance earlier, I think he'll balance our back row really well, and you've seen the quality is obviously in the World Cup with Fiji, but he's been ripping up trees for Edinburgh for a long time. So, you know, it's exciting to get him in, and I think he'll add massive value to us next year.
Yeah, no, that's obviously very exciting. And in between now and then, obviously Bristol sit fifth. I think between first and eighth, there's 12 points in it. So it's ridiculously close this year. That's obviously great for English rugby, and it's a very exciting run in. Bristol have got Newcastle, Leicester, Saris and Quins. No doubt you'll be targeting 4 wins out of 4 there, but how many wins do you think would be enough to make those playoffs?
I think 3. I think 3 will get us in there to give us a chance. And when you look at it, it's tough running. But you look at everyone's running, it's tough.
Yeah.
Because I've never seen it so competitive, never seen the league so close. When we were at Leicester, you could probably pick the top 4 most years. There'd probably be one that might be battling out for 4th, but you'd pretty much pick the top 4 before the start of the season. And how good is it to be going into 4 games to go? And 8 teams with a realistic chance of making it, and they've all got to play each other. It's some season.
We've had more than a sort of quarter of a century, I suppose, of Premiership rugby. And at the start, the three big teams in the West Country were Bath, Bristol and Gloucester. I mean, Exeter were a complete side issue. I mean, they were, people would routinely go down there with a second team on a Tuesday night. Back in the day, they didn't really count. No one would have expected that the three big teams would still be waiting for a first Premiership title between them, whereas Exeter have done what they've done. As a sort of man of Leeds and Leicester and coming in from the outside, so to speak, even though he went to Colston's, of course. Do you have any sort of thoughts on Exeter's achievement when you set it against the failure of the three traditional big teams in the area to win a Premiership title?
I think the thing is with the Exeter story, they built it right, didn't they? When they got promoted, the way that they did it, the way they went about it. And, you know, that everything was built on local players who then, you know, then they added the rest to complement the way they wanted to play and the way they wanted to do it. And I think, you know, you look at them now, they've sort of gone back round and they're trying to start that again with the young lads and the way they want to play. So, you know, I think they just got it right at the right time. And we're exactly the same. We want to do it our way. We want younger players. We want homegrown players to play for the Bears. I'd say the one thing about Bristol and the Southwest in general, Gloucester, Bath, Bristol, big crowds every week, passionate about rugby. You know, I thought it'd be leaving Leicester and going to Bristol, and obviously knowing that Bristol had been in the Championship for 12 years at the time, I didn't know what the appetite for rugby would be like. Leicester being mental, probably one of the only cities where the rugby is bigger than the football. So coming down here and experiencing what Bristol's like and how passionate the fans are and the cries that we get, even when we weren't very good. So my first year here, we were still pulling in 16,000 and we couldn't win a game. And, you know, when you go back to the Leeds thing, like, that's what you need. You need fans who are passionate and with you no matter what. So I think it'd be good for a new team to win the Prem. But it's set up for a hell of a finish.
Exeter do have a massive catchment area to draw on, of course, because of the absence of a big-time club in Cornwall. So that, do you, in terms of the sort of local talent pool, and Bristol and Bath and Gloucester are in a very concentrated area, are you clawing each other's eyes out for the best players, or do you have your sort of demarcation lines?
Obviously, like, it's tough because everyone's got boundaries, and Bristol have got the smallest catchment area out of any club in the Premiership. So it's difficult. But we've got to use that to our advantage in terms of we can get more contact time with the younger players and, you know, get them into our system. And we've had some great boys come through over the last couple of years. But again, it's like, how can we get them into the first team? How can we push that through? That's always the challenge. So, yeah, you can argue about catchment areas and people having bigger, like Leicester's got a massive catchment area. They go all the way to Norfolk and everywhere, same as you're talking about Exeter, go to Cornwall and Devon and all the way down there. But it's what can you do with what you've got? And that's the situation. So, you know, we can't complain about that. And Exeter just had a great crop at the time that then they could put a lot of people around them to make them successful.
Between second and eighth, which is Bar through to Sale inclusive, every single team is on 8 wins, 6 losses for the entire season, which, I mean, like you say, John, it's never been this close. And then either side, you've got Northampton, who are 10-4, and Gloucester, who are 4-10. So it's absolutely ridiculous. Does this mean, I guess, obviously you've got 4 games to go. 3 of those are, I forgot them now, it's Leicester, Quins, and
so Newcastle this week, Leicester, then a week break, Sarries, Quins.
Are you seeing the 3 crunch games, i.e. the 3 teams that are also in contention for top 4, as the 3 must wins?
No, we see Newcastle. Newcastle this Sunday. Win that one, then we go to the next one.
Yeah.
And that's the med like we put ourselves, we're probably behind the group to start off with. We won our first two games, and then I think we lost our next six on the trot. So we were playing catch up from the get go. And then we beat Sale at the start of the year, and then that's what I don't think we've lost since. We've almost been at that sort of last chance saloon, got a win every week since the start of the year. So that's our mentality. We've got to stay with that. There's no rest in the, and how tight it is, you never know, you might need four wins. So we've got to stay on it. The cliche week by week, but it's so, like, the thing is for me, it's so good to be in the situation fighting for it. And that's the nice thing. And that's when you ask me what's the best thing about being in professional rugby, it's obviously it doesn't feel like a job, but also it's having something on the line every week, you know, that winning feeling. When you work so hard and you get a result, that feeling, you can't replicate that in anything else that you do. So, you know, to be right in the mix of this at the business end of the season, this is what you play for. This is what you coach for. When I was at Leicester, this was the feeling that we had every year. And, you know, the mentality of it was unbelievable. And that's what you do it for.
And just one final question on that. Obviously, well, we've had a couple of Bears players on this podcast, and obviously after the initial high of Bristol Bears, which was obviously ended by that semi-final defeat to Harlequins, there has been a dip. What would represent the return of that Bristol Bears as a result this season? Would you see, you know, we're back as a playoffs result being a result of the sort of outcome of we're back?
No, I don't think we're back. I think, I think the Premiership's been competitive over the last few years, and we probably lost our way a little bit in terms of the way that we wanted to play the game and what we wanted it to look like. As I spoke about earlier, we probably conformed to the general sport of we've got to kick the ball more and things like that. And, you know, I think the nice thing about this period is we've sort of found ourselves again in terms of the way that we see the game should be played, and that's probably the journey that we've been on. So wherever we finish up, you know, I think we've got a clear direction in the way that we want to go. But saying that, where we are and we're in it, we obviously want to compete and we want to win it.
Well, I think we've sort of, as we've outlined it, is going to be a hell of a run in. And yeah, we've got a series of cracking guests lined up in the next few weeks to be able to cover that. So do stay tuned for that. And Jordan, we wish you and Bristol all the best in that run in. And hopefully we look forward to seeing you in the semi-finals and beyond.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thanks, Jordan.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Rugby Paper Podcast. And don't forget to subscribe on whichever podcast platform you use and recommend the show to your friends. The Rugby Paper is available to buy every Sunday. And to make sure you don't miss it, subscribe through our print, digital and online options at therugbypaper.co.uk/subscriptions. That's therugbypaper.co.uk/subscriptions to get all our content for as little as 14p per day.